Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Today, more than ever, people tell me they have trouble controlling their thoughts, their emotions, their feelings. You may even feel that way yourself. I'm sure you've certainly heard friends and family, co-workers discuss this. I certainly had my own struggles with this at times. And it's hardly surprising given everything we've been through over the last few years, and in particular, the last couple of years. Most of us, I think, know intellectually that we have to let go, we have to let be. But it's so much easier to say that than to practice it. So we have the perfect guest expert today. Peter Russell joins us to share insights from his work, huge body of work, and in particular his new book, Letting Go of Nothing, Relax Your Mind and Discover the Wonder of Your True Nature. Now, I've read a lot of books on this topic and I really like his approach. The book is an Eckhart Tolle edition. It's a small book, but it is packed full of practical wisdom and empowering practices to help you let go of those thoughts and feelings that block happiness and change and self-acceptance. So let me tell you a little bit about Peter. He is an author, speaker, and leading thinker on consciousness and contemporary spirituality. Peter Russell has degrees in theoretical physics and psychology, plus a master's degree in computer science. And he combines all of that with studies in meditation and Eastern philosophy. He's been to India many times. He's authored 12 books, and today we're talking about his latest. Again, it's called Letting Go of Nothing, Relax Your Mind and Discover the Wonder of Your True Nature. And here's my guest, Peter Russell. Peter Russell, welcome, welcome.
Thank you. Lovely to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you here, and I think your book is extremely timely. It's called Letting Go of Nothing, Relax Your Mind and Discover the Wonder of Your True Nature. Many spiritual traditions and philosophies emphasize the importance of letting go. You recommend a slightly different approach, but I'm wondering why now was the right time for this book for you?
I think two reasons. One, it's something I've been pondering all my life in a way, and just going deeper into it and exploring it and finding different, you know, what works best. So it's been a journey of my own, and it just now seemed the right time to write it. I just felt ready. But also I felt, you know, this time there's so much change going on in the world, we're going to have to, you know, be much more prepared to let go of some of our expectations, some of the things we get attached to, old ways of doing things. So it just seems it's going to become more and more necessary in the world today. So there were two reasons.
Right.
But, yeah.
Right. And it's a lovely book. I mean, it's a very small book. Author Rupert Spira says, short enough to be read in a weekend, profound enough to last a lifetime. And there's some really great advice and wisdom in here. So hopefully we can touch on a bit of that today. So let's look at what you mean by letting go. You recommend taking the approach of this being not one more thing to add to our to-do list, but yes, as an undoing of holding on. Can you explain that?
Yes, yes. I mean, we think of letting go as something we do. You know, people say, oh, I tried to let go, I just couldn't do it. You know, it's like, and there's no way to do letting go. We just try sort of pushing things to the back of our mind or ignoring them or trying to think of something else. And that's because we're trying to do something. We're actually doing too much. We're doing the holding on. And so the way I approach it is it's actually beginning to find ways to let the holding on relax. And as we relax the holding on, the letting go can begin to happen on its own. And I mean, I use the analogy of, you know, holding a small rock in the air. You know, to let go, you have to actually, you know, bring your attention to the hand, to the muscles, notice the tension, and then you can relax the tension and the letting go happens. So it's a similar thing with the mind. What we're releasing is the grip the mind has on some idea, some feeling, some expectation, or something that happened. And so my approach is to almost do the opposite of what we normally do, which is like try to push it away or get rid of it. I mean, ultimately, yes, we do want to be free of whatever it is we want to let go of. But I suggest the first thing to do is to do the opposite and actually allow it in, allow the experience of holding on in rather than trying to push it away.
Right. And so you say let it in and let be. And yeah. Don't try to change the feelings, get to know the sensations. And that's difficult for many people. They get very uncomfortable with those sensations. But it's like we have to feel them in order to be able to let go, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, supposing, you know, you're feeling resentful about something or anger or something like that. What we tend to do is go to our head first of all and try to sort of work it out. In our culture, we don't go to the body so easily, and yet there's so much information and wisdom in the body. So what I suggest is the first thing is just let your attention come to your body and notice what's happening. I mean, if you're angry, there's probably some tensing of the muscles somewhere. But then be curious, what else is there? And just let in whatever other feelings are there in your body. And you might discover, oh, there's something else. Oh, there's a sort of strange sensation in my back or something. Just allow it all in, but don't try to change it. So that's the letting be. Just become, you know, notice what's there. I always say something like, it's like befriending, you know, the feelings. And you'll often find, you know, we don't go there because we think it's going to be overwhelming or something. Mm. But actually, when we do go to the body, what we generally find is actually it's not so bad after all. And that's why I suggest, you know, being interested, being curious as to what's there rather than fighting it. And as we begin to do that, what often happens is the feelings begin to soften. And that beginning to soften is the beginning of the letting go beginning to happen on its own.
Right.
And also, you know, with any emotion, there's also a story going on, some narrative, something we are telling ourselves. Oh, that person did whatever it was. They were stupid because they did that or that. So just notice the same thing with the story, to let the story in and see what is it you're telling yourself about the situation, and just let that in and just let it be there. And just, you know, what often happens is you begin to see, well, actually there's another side to this story, and maybe there's something else I wasn't seeing. And again, you're beginning to let the grip the story has on you, you're beginning to let that grip relax. And as we do that, again, the feelings begin to soften.
Right. And I wanted to go into stories next. So that was a perfect segue there, because so many of us get locked into the stories we tell ourselves. And sometimes those stories are formed very early in life by someone else, and we adopt them and carry them with us. How do we become more conscious of when we're doing that, when we're locked into a story and just repeating that pattern? And how do we begin to change that story if it no longer serves us?
Right, yes, yes. Sometimes it's uncovering what the story is, because often we don't know what's there because, you know, we've been pushing it down, pushing it to the back of our minds. And so, I mean, something that I do that I find really valuable is to start writing about what's going on. If I'm feeling some emotion, I don't know what it's there, why it's there, what's going on, I just start, you know, writing and just allowing it to express itself to me that way. These stories often, they need expression, so I'm allowing it to express itself. And often when I do that, I'm not writing for any, you know, big purpose. I can throw it away afterwards. But sometimes, you know, what's going on behind that begins to reveal itself. I mean, I recently had a sort of an irritation with a close friend, and I was sort of, well, it's actually a couple. And that's what was interesting, if close friends were a couple. And I noticed something going on in me. And it was like I was resisting, I was feeling irritated. And I just sat down and just like started writing, you know, I'm feeling irritated. And lo and behold, what came out after about 5 minutes of writing is, I am seeing them through the way I saw my parents. Like, they to me are, there's something about my parents in them. Treating them psychologically as my parents. I'd never have guessed that, but by writing, it's like I began to see what it was. It was like they were fitting into my sort of image of parents, and all the stuff about parents was coming up. So that's that's what the one thing I find useful is, it's just writing about things as a way to uncover what's going on.
Right. That's so interesting, Peter. I struggled for the last couple of years with a situation that, to be perfectly honest, doesn't even affect me directly. It affects me indirectly because there are people I care about involved in that situation. But it really, it has nothing to do with me. And I'm not an angry person ever. And I kept feeling these waves of anger. And so I kind of did, you know, I journal too. And I journaled to the point where I realized I'm angry because that person didn't behave the way I expected them to, because I expect more of them. And
right.
And once I came to that realization, I won't say it's all gone, but it's a lot easier to deal with.
Exactly, exactly. Letting go doesn't have to be complete, but like there's a relaxing of the grip. And I mean, what you say about anger, that's almost universal to anger, almost like the hidden message behind any anger is, this person didn't behave as I think they should have done, with a sort of tagline, in order for me to be happy. They're upsetting,
right.
They're upsetting my ability, they're interfering with my ability to get on with life, or even, you know, maybe someone else's ability. And you know, the other side of that is, you know, we have an expectation there, they're not fulfilling our expectation.
Mm-hmm.
And our expectation is sort of like, if it were me, I'd have done it differently. That they didn't behave as I would have done, I would have done it differently. And yet if we, you know, can put ourselves in the other person's shoes and say, well, hang on, what was going on with them? I mean, you know, was there something happening to them that day? Did they have a bad night? Is there something going on in their life? Is it something from the past that came up? Not to actually try and work it out, but just to open things up to say, you know, really, I have no idea what was actually going on with them when they did this. I may have some guesses, but I don't really have any idea. And that, again, allows us to sort of relax the story, to let it go.
Right, right. Very well noted. I'm taking note of that for future reference. You say emotions are more than feelings. And of course, you touched on this a little bit. Seldom do we have an emotion without some kind of story attached to it.
Yep.
How do we differentiate between emotions and feelings? Or is it just the story that we're attaching?
Well, we use feelings in two ways. It's interesting. You know, we talk about feeling as a feeling in the body. You know, I notice, you know, there's a tingling feeling or something, or I'm feeling an ache. You know, we use feeling in that sense, a body feeling, and we use feeling for an emotion. You know, I feel happy, I feel sad, I feel irritated, whatever. And the reason is because any emotion has some feeling quality to it. And an emotion is what psychologists call, there's an action tendency to it. With any emotion, it's actually an impulse to do something, to act in some way, whether it's to, you know, punch a person or to hide away, whatever it is. There's some sort of action tendency, which we don't actually do anything about, but it sits there in the body as some feeling. But it's triggered by something going on in our mind, a story. And so the two get wrapped up together. The story is what triggers the feeling, because the story is, this is not right, it's dangerous, or I'm not going to be safe here, or there's something wrong with it, whatever it is. Or even, you know, oh, this is absolutely wonderful, and then we get all excited in the body as well.
Mm.
So the story, what I call the story, that triggers the feeling. And the brain doesn't care whether the story is true or not. It reacts the same way. And so the body starts preparing for action in some way. So the two are sort of wrapped up together. I like to think of it like you've got a ball of red string and white string, and you know they're all rolled up together into a ball string. And from a distance, it looks like a pink ball. But when you unravel it, it's got both, you know, white and red. And it's the same with an emotion. When we sort of unravel the emotion, we see there's both things there. There's, I would say, almost all things there. It's very hard to have an emotion without actually thinking about the past or future in some way or other.
Right.
So the two interplay, and of course what happens is, you know, we feel the feeling in our body and we think, oh, we get tense. That reinforces the story about how awful that person was, and that reinforces the feeling in the body. And we, you know, we human beings can continue doing this for months over something that happened.
Right, right.
We hold on to it.
Right, yes, and many spiritual teachers and philosophers and psychiatrists, they talk about the importance of letting go of ego, or at least recognizing when we're coming from a place of ego. You say there is no ego. What, tell us where you're coming from on that.
Yeah. Actually, the phrase I use is there is no such thing as ego, with the emphasis on thing. Some of my sort of subtitles are deliberately provocative like that.
Right, okay.
No, there's no such thing as ego. You know, we tend to think of, we say my ego, I've got a something or other ego, or my ego got in the way. We treat it as a noun, and we imagine there's some part of me, almost some entity, there's a separate part of me, some self, which is ego. But when I look inside my own experience, I don't find some part of me, some separate part of me, which I label ego. I find there's this sense of being, this sense of I, which is always there. And there's lots of experiences, thoughts, and different things. And some of those thoughts, I might say, are egocentric thoughts. And they're thoughts about what I need, often at the expense of others, or whatever. So we find egocentric thoughts. And so what I'm saying really is the ego is not a thing inside us. It's a mode of thinking we get caught in, a self-centered mode of thinking we get caught in. And that to me is important, because if you think of ego as a thing, then you get into what, you know, in some spiritual traditions, it's like we've got to get rid of the ego, we've got to conquer it,
right.
We've got to overcome it, we've got to do it. And it seems, you know, this becomes a long battle with some thing we think is there, some enemy.
Like it's a separate identity almost that some people talk about it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But if you see it as just a mode of thinking that we get caught in, then instead of like being free of the ego is some long-term goal if you do enough practices and meditation or whatever, it's something we can be free of in any moment. We can choose actually, but we notice ourselves getting caught up in a certain thought stream, and we think, you know, this is pretty egocentric. We actually have the choice to pause that thought stream, to just pause it for a moment and step out of it. So we can sort of be free of ourselves in the moment. It may come back again later, but then the practice is like coming back out of it. So we can actually sort of drop that way of thinking at any time we notice it. And that to me is a much more productive way of approaching letting go of ego, as something we can just let go of time and time again whenever it comes up, rather than getting rid of some thing, some part of me.
Right.
So for me, it's an important distinction.
Very important, yes. And really well explained there. So let's talk about love. You have a couple of chapters on love, one called Loving Yourself. And, you know, we've been through so much collectively and individually over the past few years. A lot of people are weary, they're beating up on themselves. I hear people say they're disappointed in themselves for a number of reasons. One thing I hear a lot is, you know, I didn't accomplish anything during COVID lockdown, or they could have done more, or made better use of their time. They could have written the next great American novel or learned new skills. And so they have this feeling of disappointment in themselves, and they're beating up themselves, which is kind of adding to everything else that's going on. So I want to talk about self-love and self-compassion and what
right.
you call a deeper way of loving ourselves, loving the pure or the
yes.
true self.
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. In some ways, I mean, judgment is the opposite to love. You know, we think hate, you know, the common thing is hate is the opposite to love. But I see judgment as the opposite to love. I believe our sort of intrinsic nature is one of, I call it lovingness, when we really come back to ourselves. There's just this feeling of lovingness. And what happens is we start judging other people. If we judge someone, we're not really loving them, because love to me is acceptance
right.
of another person's being. And when we judge ourselves, we're not really accepting ourselves, we're, you know, holding something against ourselves. So as long as there's judgment, I think there can't be love in a normal sense. And that's why, you know, when we talk about loving yourself on a sort of daily level, we're saying, you know, to actually love yourself without judgment. Love your, you know, all your faults, all your good things, all your faults, whatever. Just love it all. And which, you know, comes from letting go of judgment. But there's a deeper sense of loving that I'm pointing to in the book, which is, it's to do with how we, when the mind settles down, we come to a state of stillness and quietness. There's several qualities there. One is usually a sense of ease, of peace, some even call it happiness, contentment. And we notice this sense of lovingness, which is there. And the deeper we drop into ourselves, the more this sense of ease and lovingness is there. And it's actually a delicious experience, I find, delicious experience. And in a way, we can't help but love that. And that, to me, is our deeper self. Our true deeper self is at ease. It is loving. And so loving ourselves, in the sense of loving our deeper self, our true self, is almost inevitable. Once we taste it, we're going to love it. And the more we love it, the more we want to taste it again.
Right.
So that's what I mean, a different way of loving ourselves, more spiritual way of loving ourselves.
And I love that word delicious. Who doesn't want that? So that's great.
And it is delicious. It's like, ah. And you know, when you're sitting in that state, you know, I'm sure people know from time to time in meditation, you don't want it. It's like, what else would I need? You know, it's like, this is wonderful. I don't need anything else at this moment.
Right. You say there's a lot of value in asking, who am I? And even though that sounds a very simple question, I know a lot of people seem to struggle with that beyond, you know, the basic, oh, I'm a teacher, I'm a wife, I'm a husband, I'm a dad, whatever. How do you ask that of yourself when you're going through that?
Yes. This came up, the superficial way, you know, the everyday way of looking at it, but the question in spiritual circles, it really came, it got popular by Ramana Maharshi 100 years ago, who posed this question, who am I, as an inner inquiry. It's not meant to say, you know, who are you in the world, you know, as you say, the roles you play, your name, all these things, your nationality. He's not pointing at that. It's an inquiry into, what do we mean by I? I sometimes rephrase it as, what am I? What does the word I point to? So it's like an inner inquiry as to, what do I actually mean by I in its deepest sense? Not me as a personality. Leaving all that behind, the I, if you like, what is the I that is aware of this personality? What is the I that is aware of the thinking? What is the I that is aware that I'm talking to you right now? And it's not a question to be answered by the mind that just takes us back into, you know, personal stuff. It's actually a sort of inner exploration, just to sit quietly and just hold that question as an inquiry. And what you tend to find is you begin to drop back into a recognition of this quality of beingness. Some people call it just that sense of I am, not I am anything or anybody, but just this sense of I am, which is actually always there. It's that same sense of being that was, you know, there yesterday, 10 years ago, when I was a kid. That hasn't changed. You know, the personal I can change a lot, but this sense of being, this sense of like the deep sense of me-ness, that's what they're pointing to. And it's more about recognizing what is there, because in a way it's always there, but we don't notice it. It isn't discovering some new, wonderful, exotic state of consciousness. It's actually allowing the mind to become quiet enough that you notice this quality of this I-ness that's always there.
Right.
So in a way we're removing the veils to it. We're not so much creating something or discovering something. We're removing the veils to something which we don't normally notice, because our mind is so directed out onto what we're thinking, what we're doing, all that stuff.
Right. So it's almost like the essence of who I am.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is.
Okay.
It is. And when you notice it, it's funny. There's no way to describe it. That's why many teachings say it's ineffable. It can't be put in words.
Right.
Not because we don't have the words. It's because there's nothing, there's no qualities to describe. It's, you know, we can say when I'm, you know, when I'm resting in it, I feel at ease, I feel loving when I'm resting in it. But the eye itself, it's absolutely familiar, but there's no easy way to describe it. It's sort of a slight paradox.
So let's talk about imagination, because I tend to think of imagination as always being a good thing. Well, unless I'm having nightmares, right? Horrific nightmares, something like that. But certainly if we work in a creative field as I do, it's helpful to have a good imagination.
Yes.
But you say imagination can actually get in the way of our happiness. You write, our imagination can be so engrossing, it eclipses our present in the moment experience. So talk to us about that, if you would, please.
Yes. I mean, first of all, you know, I totally agree with you that imagination is really valuable. It's what made our species what we are. It's behind all our creativity. You know, we imagine alternatives and how to do them. It's absolutely fundamental, really, to human being, human, and to human culture. So, you know, just to get clear on that, I'm not dissing imagination. It's really, really important. But what can happen is it starts getting triggered when it doesn't need to be. You know, I might start imagining, well, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow? I wonder what, you know, what's the weather going to be like, or this, or am I going to meet somebody, or that could go wrong, or maybe this will happen. So in our imagination, we start creating, if you like, another story about something. And our imagination is always going out to the future or to the past in our imagination. I mean, memory, you could say, occurs in our imagination. In the strict sense, imagination is having images in the mind, pictures in the mind. It shrinks, that's what it means. And so when we do that, we can get lost in our stories, we get lost in our fantasies. And because they're all about the past or the future, we lose touch with the present moment. So when we're caught up in some or other daydream, we also call it daydreaming, it's part of the imagining, daydreaming about something. When we're caught up in that, our attention is out into whatever we're imagining, daydreaming about. And so what that does is it takes us away from experiencing the present moment, just being in the present, which again, there's so many teachings have pointed to, Ram Dass, be here now. But we can't be here now in our attention if it's off on some other thing. So that's the main thing it does. That's the first thing it does. It takes us out of the present moment. But also, it often creates a lot of unnecessary tension, stress, worry. You know, often we find ourselves, you know, trying to solve problems which don't exist, may never exist. But, you know, we're busy catching up. What if that? Or if I were in this situation, what would I do? You know, I know to my own mind, I get lost in these sort of, or maybe I do that. Is that to me is a misuse of the imagination, where we're just wandering around, you know, what if only, that sort of stuff. And to say it's taking us away from the present, but also it's creating tension in ourselves very often.
Yes, definitely. And it's one of those things, it kind of relates to that saying, don't borrow trouble, when you're like thinking, what if this could happen in the future kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Discontent is a big thing. You talk about this in the book, and a lot of our discontent, I'm in the communications business. I've been a communications strategist for many years now. You know, I've written many advertisements where we persuade you, you must have this to feel great about yourself and your life, and you're not hip if you don't have, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
So I understand all the neuroscience that goes into persuasion and telling us what we need to do. There's a gap there between, you know, our current reality and where we'd like to be or think we should be.
Yeah. Yeah,
so yeah. What do you have to say about discontent and letting go?
and contentment. You see, I think fundamentally what we're all looking for is to be content. That's our fundamental motivation. You can put different words on it, happiness, peace, whatever. But it's like we're looking to feel okay. Behind everything we do, we're looking to feel okay. And if there's something wrong in our world, you know, if we, you know, go out on a, you know, steaming hot day or something, and it's like, you know, we might feel a bit, you know, it's too much, we go inside and, you know, go back to the air conditioning. You know, we feel discontent. The discontent is a motivation to do something in the world and so come back to feeling contentment. So it's a very natural thing, discontent. It's the motivation to actually do something to take care of ourselves as we're seeking to be more content. But what's happened in our society, and I think it happens in nearly every society, we're sort of hypnotized into the idea, really from the moment we're born, that if you're not happy, if you're not content, you need to do something about it. You're missing something. You need to change something, get something. And that, you know, that goes on through schooling, through media, as you say, through advertising. I mean, just about every advertisement that ever is saying you're missing something. There's something you lack, and you can't be happy until you've got it. And so we're fueling, our society is fueling the discontent, and we then run around doing all these things, chasing things in the hope that if we just got the world to be the way we want it to be, had enough things, we will finally be content. And I think the sort of the sad joke is we are so busy worrying about whether or not we're going to be content in the future. We're so, you know, busy creating discontent for ourselves that we can't be content in the present. I mean, it's almost by definition, if you're discontent about something, you can't be content. And so the letting go is, you know, recognizing when this is happening, recognizing when we're creating discontent, recognizing when we're solving problems that may never exist, and letting them go. Just, you know, again, what we talked about earlier, letting the mind relax, letting that story go. And as we do, we find ourselves coming back to what I call just natural contentment.
Right.
I think the mind, when it's not worrying, when it's not perturbed by what's going on, the unperturbed mind is naturally in a state of contentment. So we need to do things, yes, but also a lot of the things we're doing are actually taking us away from that natural state of contentment.
Yes, there is, I don't know if you've seen this, Peter, there's a fascinating documentary by Adam Curtis. He was BBC documentary filmmaker. It's called The Century of Self, where he talks about how the American government after the war wanted to quiet the mob, control the mob, meaning Americans, and used a lot of the psychological and propaganda techniques that they used during the war. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yes, he's a fascinating filmmaker.
Yes, very much so. So what does peace look like for you? You know, people are often in search of peace, and I think people describe that differently. They have different expectations around it. How do you define it for yourself?
Almost like it's an absence of worry. It's an absence of worry, concern. It's being in a quiet state of mind. It's like being at peace in myself, or being at peace with myself. It's just a feeling of ease, a deep sense of okayness, often with a sense of relief. I'm sort of relieved of the, you know, the worries I'm having. So it's just, I mean, to put words on it again, it starts getting hard to put actual words on it. I think we all know what it means in a way, but the problem is we're, you know, looking for it in the world. We're looking to be at peace out there, as opposed to discovering how we can actually notice this quality of peace in ourselves.
Mm.
So I think for me, when talking about, you know, true self, that, you know, the natural state of ease, contentment, peace for me is part of that. I feel at peace because I'm not at war with anything in myself.
Right. That's a good description, and it is almost the absence of, you know, other stuff. You share in the book the old Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times, which of course we do. I did not know until I read your book that actually was a curse. I thought it was a blessing.
Right. Yes. I mean, yes. It's a curse because interesting times, there tends to be a lot going on. There's a lot of change. They're usually not peaceful times. You know, uninteresting times would be times, you know, be times of, you know, static, where life is gentle. What we're moving into is like, with so much change and change accelerating, there's the times are going to be very interesting indeed. But interesting times in that sense mean there's a lot to adapt to, there's a lot of change happening, there's a lot, you know, that could be sources of, you know, worry or stress or impact us in some way. So that's why it's seen as a curse. Like we say, may you live in interesting times, is like, if you're living in interesting times, they may not be that welcome.
Right, buckle up.
The times are getting interesting.
That's not
intellectually interesting. You know, we think, oh, that's an interesting, that was an interesting movie, it made me thought, think about something rather. It's not so much interesting in that sense. It means there's a lot going on, a lot to,
I've heard my brother say it many times lately, so. So I know you talk a great deal about consciousness at a global level. As we move forward, hopefully towards the end of this pandemic, what message do you want to put out there about humanity, about us moving forward? It's a big question, I know, but...
It's a big question, and there's many answers to it. I think, you know, one thing is what we've been talking about here. I think we all can connect with this deeper place inside ourselves. And as we do that, we can find really what it is we're looking for in life. But also, I think, to recognize that's what everybody else is looking for. I mean, everybody ultimately is looking in one way or another to become back to a state of, you know, whether we call it contentment, peace, whatever, to be loved, to love more. We all want the same thing, but we go about it in very, very different ways. And we tend to get upset about how someone else is going about getting it for themselves. And so what I suggest to people is to actually remember that. Have your intention in any interaction you have with a person, a conversation or something you're doing with them. Always have the intention that the other person should feel good as a result of this. Which means removing attack thoughts. I mean, it's easy, you know, you could say something to me and you meant it, you know, you came from a wonderful place, but I sort of misinterpret, I feel slightly attacked, and then I'm going to sort of come back with some sort of subtle attack, it may be whatever it is, something, body tone or something. Two people can easily get into a sort of mutual attack, like saying, I want you to love me better, but I'm going to dig the knife in just a little bit so you'll realize the error of your ways, treat me better. And it's really undoing that, which happens so often in relationships. It's like, okay, can I spot those times when I'm, you know, my motive in this conversation is to actually have a little attack, to actually blame you or make you feel bad about something. To take that out and replace it with the motivation, how can I do this so that you feel good, that you feel loved, you don't feel rejected, you don't feel you're suffering, you don't feel criticized. I mean, there's oftentimes we do need to give critical feedback, but the question is, you know, can we do that in a way that is kind?
Right, I love that.
And this is really the principle, you know, it's the golden rule of all traditions, treat other people as you would like to be treated.
Right.
And I think this to me is kindness. We all want to be treated with kindness. So
yes.
Let us treat others with kindness.
Yes, we need much more of that. You've been doing this a long time. You've had an incredible amount of study and experience along the way in different fields. And I'm wondering what you know now that you wish you'd known 30 or 40 years ago. Again, a big question.
what comes up is what we're talking about in a way. 30, 40 years ago, a bit more, when I started getting interested in this whole area, I thought, you know, spiritual awakening or enlightenment, I don't like the word particularly, but whatever it is, you know, spirituality was coming to some amazing, new, wonderful, exotic, blissful experience that was going to happen to us, or we were going to discover this wonderful higher state of consciousness. And what I've gradually learned over the years is it's not that. It's just peeling away all the layers that actually prevent us just really being in touch with our true self. And I'm still, you know, I'm finding more and more layers to, you know, peel away at times. It's an ongoing journey. But if I'd known that 30, 40 years ago, I don't think I'd have been chasing experiences so much. I think I'd have been, you know, practicing what I am practicing now more.
Right, right. So it's been great talking with you today, Peter Russell. And I want to let listeners know what a challenge we had to get together today for our scheduled interview, and what a great sport you were while we were having digital issues. I don't know where they arose or why they arose, but they were causing us problems, and you rose like a champion, so I appreciate it.
Well, we let go of it.
We let go.
And eventually it happened, and here we are, it happened. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, so the book is, it's an Eckhart Tolle edition. It's a beautiful little book, packed full of wisdom. Letting go of nothing, relax your mind, and discover the wonder of your true nature is the title of it. And listeners can find out much more about Peter and his work at peterrussell.com. A final thought, Peter, you'd like to leave listeners with today?
Don't worry. I mean, we need to worry at times, but just, you know, spot those unnecessary worries and let them be.
Love it. Thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
And love to be with you.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
These are the sounds of a dinner. A dinner that almost didn't happen. A dinner now served, thanks to people like you. Due to COVID-19, 17 million more Americans may face hunger. Feeding America is helping our neighbors in need. And if you're able, you can too. Donations are being accepted at feedingamerica.org/coronavirus. Brought to you by the Ad Council and Feeding America, 200 food banks strong.